Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Double Crossed Radio, coming to you live from Jefferson. And tonight, I usually say I'm joined tonight by my partner, broadcast partner Drew Lamb, but Drew is not able to be with us tonight. He has his grandfather is having some serious health problems, and he's with him right now. And so if you're of such a persuasion, you could include him and his family in your prayers tonight. But we are joined, as promised, on our Facebook page by Greg Askins. Greg, how are you tonight?
I'm doing well.
And if I sound a little bit different, it's because I have a little bit of a head cold. I'm almost over it, but I'm probably going to sound like this for a couple more days. I can do Barry White right now. So it's going to be, as you guys are listening on podcast, who is this guy pretending to be Chuck? Well, that's still Chuck. It's just how it is tonight. And we have a great show lineup. I'm going to not waste too much more time. I do have one news flash for everybody out there. We've had as a frequent guest on our show, Miner Dave Everest, and we're not going to include him tonight in the show. I don't think we have enough time, but if we do at the end, I know he's always down there in chat. We may, but his case that he has been filing and he keeps losing and he appeals and keeps losing is now his lawyer has agreed that it's worth a try, and they're submitting it to the Supreme Court. Now, it may or may not get taken up, but I think just the fact that his lawyer feels that strongly about it is a tremendous achievement for Miner Dave. And so, Miner Dave, a tip of the hat to you. You've won over another convert, and as people understand what exactly is at stake here, they fall in behind you, because what you're on the right side, and doesn't mean that the deck still isn't stacked against you, but you do have the most important piece of the puzzle, and that's the truth. So good luck to you on this, and I hope that the truth prevails in your case, and for all of our cases, really, for all of our sake. But anyway, we're going to get down to our show tonight, because there's a lot of stuff. We had on Greg about 5 or 6 weeks ago talking about this, and we wasted a little bit too much time at the beginning of the show, and we didn't even get through a fourth of what he had to talk about. So I promised him we'd have him on again to finish up on glyphosate. Plus, I've spent the time since then kind of studying a little bit by myself, so I can ask some better questions, because Greg was so far ahead of where I was in terms of my knowledge of it. I said, "Wow, I'm just a listener tonight. I'm not really a host, so I'm going to be a better host, and we're going to get right into this." Greg, I don't remember where we left off, but
me neither.
There's a lot of stuff that's happened since then. I think some of the funny stuff that's happened since then is he claimed he wasn't a lobbyist for Monsanto, but he was on some show in France, or for a documentary in France they were filming, and he was claiming that there was nothing in glyphosate that would harm you, and they offered him a jar of it to drink, and he said, "No, do you think I'm stupid?"
Yeah.
So we can start with that people even that know that this is bad have no problem lying about it. I guess if you're paid enough, you can say anything. Is that kind of what you feel about this?
Yeah, I mean, it's always been this story of say one thing and bowl over the science to reinforce your story, right? I mean, that's part of this whole thing. Like this guy here, his real name was Dr., and that's even a stretch, but Patrick Moore, that was his name, the guy that was offered his quote was literally, to back it up here, just one more, he said literally, "You can drink a whole quart of it and it won't hurt you." So had he not prefaced the interview with that statement, it would seem kind of dickish to bring out a glass of glyphosate. But he's the one that brought it up. And he's the one that denied that he would, be able to drink it. So anyway, yeah, this is just the way they've been operating. And this is not anything new. The carcinogen reports from the EPA go back into the 60s, from the very beginning of the research into the effects of glyphosate or as they call it, Roundup. And they've just continually hidden the truth by whatever means necessary. You know, recently they've taken the French scientists, what's his name? Seralini, I believe, right?
I didn't read that one.
So yeah, so it's a French,
you got me on that one.
French scientist that was studying the effect on rats.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know the guy's name, but I know that study, yeah.
Yeah, they called the Seralini study. And there was the issue was that to shut him up, right, or to close down this research, they purchased the scientific paper, the journal that was actually carrying the story. And they published, or they forced the new editor to publish a retraction. So anyway, today I just heard that Seralini is starting a new investigation independently, and he's opening up the research to everyone, and he's going to try to do it in the open, so that they can't deny it, you know?
And I think one of the other things they tried to do in that case, they tried to sue him for intellectual property violations by not getting their permission to experiment on their product, which is sold in stores. I mean, it's like, is there you have to sign a thing now? It's a waiver saying you won't.
Well, I mean,
you won't use this on experiments to prove it's a carcinogen or something.
Like that DMCA Act, right? I mean, that was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and they use that all the time when they want to mess with somebody on a technicality, basically.
Yeah.
Right? It's a way of getting around them.
Just to kind of review this study, those of you who don't remember, this was the guy that did the study with lab rats, and the rats got tumors that were so big they couldn't walk anymore.
Right.
They were like a living tumor, just
right,
with fur on it. Yeah,
and he also,
gross.
In the statement that he uses just to describe it, he's saying that this isn't a new study. This is just redoing a study that Monsanto was required to do. And the difference was that Monsanto's end result of their report was too many rats died to get any result. So that's how they concluded their research was, they all died. And that was okay. I don't understand how that was allowed, but anyway, they're trying to argue, that this guy let his rats live too long and they just naturally would have gotten these tumors anyway, and that was bogus, obviously. And
Because that's the natural end of every rat's life.
Oh, sure. Of course, they're just all
cancerous tumors. Yeah. That's why they use them in labs all the time.
I know. Yeah, it was really stupid.
I mean, how dumb do they think people are to believe this stuff?
They basically know that they are going to be able to spin this no matter what happens. They've been masters of this. I mean, if you can survive the bad PR from Agent Orange and still be in business, then, you know, you're a master.
And then make it into a weed killer for people in the United States.
Right. It'd be worse. I mean, it couldn't be worse, right? I mean, they were using exactly the same stuff that they knew was carcinogenic and genotoxic, right? It causes inherited genetic mutation. It's horrible stuff anyway. So the point is, all these things could have been regulated a long time ago. Now they are mostly released into the wild and in a non-controlled way, and they're losing effectiveness. So they're going to have to move on to something worse, which this year they've asked for the full 2,4-D to be released. And basically they're using the same argument. Well, hey, it's just as safe as glyphosate. It's just as safe, but I won't drink it. But they won't, it's 2,4-D is a lot closer to Agent Orange. It's just a really, really strong version of the glyphosate, is the Roundup that we've been using. And the reason why they have to update or go stronger is because it's the plants and the bugs have mutated and have now got a way around it.
Yeah,
they've evolved.
Agent Orange caused a lot of cancer in Vietnam from both Vietnamese and American soldiers who were doused with it, and a lot of really strange cancers that are very, very, very rare showed up in the people who were exposed to it, and they died hideous deaths within, you know, 10 to 20 years after they'd served there.
I still see guys that come into my store that have effects of the spraying of Agent Orange. They're still alive, but it's been a torturous existence. And one guy carries around an oxygen tank with him constantly. His lungs are essentially destroyed and have been that way for, you know, 30 years. He's not gotten any better, but he's not really gotten any worse. It's not good.
One of Alex Jones' uncles died recently of a virus that was pretty lethal in Texas last year. I think it was last year. Could have been the year before. But anyway, he had the same thing. His heart and lungs were just like shredded cheese or like Swiss cheese. There's just so many holes in them from Agent Orange. And they said there was scar tissue all over that stuff. And it was amazing he lived as long as he did. He was eventually killed by something else. And so that it doesn't get marked down on the Agent Orange list, but it probably was a contributing factor to
in
his immune system response and everything else.
And that's how they get away with this a lot of times, is that they can ignore the results and say, oh, well, that could have been something else. That might have been something else.
Yeah.
That's how they're getting away with this current report, is they're hiding behind the word probably, which is that, you know, it's not definitive. Maybe it does. Maybe it doesn't cause cancer.
Well,
but I think it's pretty obvious.
Let's go back a little bit on the history of this stuff, of how long it's been included in our food supply. Because I think a lot of people will think, well, they've been using it since Vietnam. Well, no, it didn't get approved to be put on plants and things that we eat until the 1980s.
Right. Yeah, it was way after. I mean, and that was after.
I think originally it was only in test plots, and then it was for full commercial use maybe at the end of the 1980s.
Right. And it was being used throughout the 60s. I mean, that's not to say it's not being used. It just wasn't approved. It just hadn't gotten to that stage yet.
Well, and they weren't putting it on food. They were putting it on lawns and stuff like that.
They were putting it on earlier, so that the concept was that it would have washed off or it would have decomposed naturally.
Yeah, that was another myth, that it would decompose.
They keep pushing that limit to how close can you apply this pesticide before the harvest. So, like, could it be 12 hours before you harvest? Could it be 2 weeks before? Could it be a month before? You know, they try to push the limit right up to like the day of harvest, and that's like their ultimate goal, was that you would lay it down, coat it in their product, you will spray it the entire life of it, and when you're harvesting it, you'll, you know, maybe see the same results. I mean, their claim is that it's going to be better results, and so far that doesn't add up, because in every possible measure, they're getting lower output. You know, cost the farmer more, and they have less.
Right, the farmers are becoming less productive, and the food costs go up.
This was a power grab.
Technology is supposed to make things more efficient and cheaper, so that the consumer would benefit with a better quality product, or at least the same quality product at a lower price. It's just the opposite. It's a lower quality product at a higher price.
Right, and with a concept that is just insane. I mean, honestly, in the future, people are going to have to look back at this, if assuming there are anyone surviving this, and they will say this was just absolute insanity. There's no way you could have an entire society that is blind to the facts and just willing to not just spray this stuff on their own lawns, but have it on their schools and in their neighborhoods and on their crops. And then what's worse now is when the plant is engineered to produce the toxin inside of itself, and that somehow is going to be okay for people to consume. You know, that the theory was, well, it won't kill you, but it will kill grasshoppers that eat it because of their size, primarily. I mean, the concept, if you drank the equivalent amount that we're giving to the bugs, then it will kill you just the same, because we're affected in the same way. It's just, if they realistically believe that you could microdose yourself with a poison and it's not harmful, I just don't think that's true. I think we've always found that's not.
It's clear
truth.
From this scientist that was interviewed in the documentary, he doesn't believe it either.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, what it really does is most people don't realize there's a lot of unless you don't really call them fauna. There's a lot of bacteria that live, helpful bacteria that lives in your digestive tract,
right, and in the soil.
Billions of bacterial cells.
Yep.
And they produce a lot of things that your body doesn't produce on its own, and therefore they're kind of essential to good health.
Correct.
And
they'll help you to break down things.
If this is lethal to a grasshopper, I guarantee you it's lethal to those bacteria.
Correct. And that's why we're seeing all those different issues related to digestive problems. Everything from like Crohn's and celiac and, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, all these different
food allergies.
Yeah. It's all related. But the major thing that has been, I think, passed over in sort of a fundamental health understanding of how important those probiotics, the good bacteria in your gut, are, in that they're probably responsible for a majority, like over half of our immune system response is in the gut. And that's something that's been passed over. And
yeah, I was listening to that interview that Alex did with Dr. McCullough. And in between interruptions from Alex, Dr. McCullough had some amazing things to say. I don't know why Alex, he's just like a child at Christmas time. He's got to be the center of attention, I guess. I didn't realize this before, but the gut bacteria is actually responsible for 90% of the serotonin that your body produces. You only get 10% of it is produced by your own body. The rest of it is produced by these bacteria, which are they produce serotonin, and it's used for, you know, it helps you feel better. You know, a good, you know, it's avoid depression and all this, right, sort of thing. Right. You have a good mental state. And a lot of people that are feeling depressed and get put on SRIs, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, are suffering actually from the effects of the Roundup on their food.
Right. The long-term effects of digesting and having your water.
You think this can't affect you? Yeah. Just what if you'd been on that plane that the pilot who was coming off of those antidepressants decides he's going to fly the plane into the Alps. You know, that's how it's affecting us in society. You don't think that this stuff is serious or it's a problem, or, you know, I don't feel depressed, so it's not my problem. Well, it is a problem.
Right. And it's easy to hide those sort of effects, because, again, they can do the old probably. It's probably that, but it could probably be something else. Maybe it's just that person's particular, you know, issue. But, yeah, I think that this is just part of a larger cover-up, that anytime logic can't prevail in an argument, whenever somebody just seems like a shill that's being paid and is obstinate and doesn't really have anything to back up their statements, you know, you always kind of come to the same conclusion that this is a conspiracy, that this product is manufactured by a company that has very close ties to the military industrial complex, that the cover up is real, that because there have been actual financial rewards, there have been multiple military personnel that have sued, and there's, you know, the fact that the rest of the world knows what we did, and they have to question the motives of this company. You know, why is it that when they were pressured on this, rather than backing down, which would have been a realistic standpoint, and said, well, yeah, let's just keep it in a test environment. Let's just maybe test it on an island, or, you know, like some realistic thing, instead of just, oh no, we'll just release it everywhere. It's totally fine. We don't need any research. you know, that's when you have to question, you know, the whole story, because there's just no logic to it. There's just nothing that makes any sense. So anyway.
And it's, you know, it's not like this is something that isn't going to, even if you don't eat the products that are sprayed with it, it's, there's a lot of other ways that you can ingest it. It's in almost everything that's manufactured as a food.
Right. And it's
so if you ever eat a mass-produced cookie or a, you know, anything that's grown on with water that might have glyphosate in it, like potatoes, potato chips. It's
well, and any Roundup Ready version of a product is going to contain
higher amounts.
Well, yeah, because they've sprayed more of it on it. I mean, that's the whole point of the purpose of a Roundup Ready crop is that you can spray more Roundup. It's not to use less because it wouldn't do any good. The plant
and they use it
immune to the effects of it. That's how it works. So anyway,
back in the 50s, a guy named Ansel Keys changed the way we eat. And I don't think he was a conspirator. He was involved in the same way, but he set the table for these guys very nicely.
Yeah.
He introduced this food pyramid, which put grains on the bottom and said you just had to eat a ton of grains to be healthy. And that was the major thing. That was the base for everything else, is you had to have a lot of grains. So
good.
Yeah, and it actually has turned out that probably isn't the truth anyway, but we should have a higher fat diet, but animal fat, not so much vegetable fat, but there are some vegetable fats that are digestible. Getting off topic a little bit, but that set the table by changing the way we eat. We consume a lot more bread at that point in time. Well, then all they had to do is come along with they changed the way they started harvesting wheat. They started saying harvesting bread. Yeah. It's like bread grows on a tree.
Well, I think that actually began before World War II. I have some family that was involved in wheat farm, and they've been pretty adamant about the story that in the early 40s, the government agents arrived and confiscated their seed and traded them for seed that was issued by the government on the basis that it was, you know, it would be the patriotic thing to do. You know, that was the way they were convincing people back then. But you weren't allowed to ask, you know, what's going on? Where did this come from? What's different about it? You were just told plant this instead. It's good for the country. And that basis, I mean, I think they were all convinced that it was going to have a higher output. But they really didn't know what was involved in it. And so later on, the brother of this farmer actually had been serving in a secret capacity in World War II and did research on the effects of gamma ray radiation on people and plants and animals. And so he told him about a story that the military was conducting research in agriculture where they were using spent fuel from reactors, like a fuel rod, and they would just place it into the middle of various garden plants. You know, they'd plant a garden full of tomatoes and we'd shove a nuclear rod down the middle of it, and whatever survived or mutated, that's what they got. And so it was pretty much a random mutation generator. You know, you're blowing the hell out of stuff. Something's going to happen. Hopefully it's good. Maybe it's not. I think the theory the government was working with was that the crops in the future would be then more radioactive resistant, perhaps, or they were just desperate for new DNA, right? And so we didn't have the capacity to slice it up in the laboratory. We just kind of randomly generated it. So anyway, this was large in part how they created the modern versions of corn and wheat and tomatoes and cucumbers and a lot of plants that before World War II were not food you know, because they didn't produce a lot or they weren't in the same way, right? So corn used to be a much, much wider, looser, like a grass. It's a lot more like sorghum in nature. It took a lot of hybridizing, which honestly was done with hard work. And then some of this just random mutation stuff came along, and it's part of it. That's allowed this the habits of these plants to change. So they produce more, and, you know, we don't really know what all is involved because of that mutations in the past that have been held over. So anyway.
That goes a long way to explain why the explosion of these really diseases that were unknown 70 years ago has just happened. And then in my lifetime, we've gone from having things like Alzheimer's was unknown when I was a child.
Right.
And one of the effects of all the stuff with the glyphosate is that it's destroying the things that keep your brain healthy in your gut.
Right.
And then we get the, there's other things too. We can talk about the statin drugs and the, how that's a brain killer. That's a heart killer too. It's a muscle poison. But it's a lot of these things are developed to counteract the effects of the new food.
Well, and that's it. None of this was in our diet. The government was partly involved in this reordering of our priorities for sure. Definitely if you were, 200 years ago, you know, before this nonsense came around, you'd have a vastly different diet. You know, might not be better. I'm not saying that. I don't think anybody wants to go back and just eat gruel all the time. But I think that we as a species cannot evolve fast enough to keep up with the changes in our diet. It's going to take a few hundred years.
Yeah, it's going to take many generations.
Yeah, just for the existing changes to take. And they're continually, the accelerating pace of change isn't going to stop. There's going to be more mutations still, to the point where we're going to see foods that have never been seen before because they didn't exist at all. And that's not just to say, like, I mean, right now they're going into Mexico, for instance, and looking for exotic fruits and vegetables that might appeal to Americans. Like, there's just the concept of appeal, because it's different, is a big thing right now. And so for profit motive, of course, they're looking for stuff, not necessarily for nutritional value. They're looking at people stopped buying apples because they're tired of them, so we got to find something else, you know. And it'll only take a matter of time, and they'll figure out a way to patent it, which will involve their injecting either the BT gene or whatever they come up with next that allows the plant to be patentable, right?
I think they'll use something like a Dole plantation or something like that. All the big multinational farming corporations, you know, the industrial food complex is all over the world. Any place where the land is cheap, they'll buy it. And
well, in our recent conversions, you know, they're really looking at tropical regions. They wanted to. They've been growing in Maui for quite a while because of the fact that they are getting 3 and 4 crops a year, because it's basically perpetually summer. And with a little bit of additional auxiliary lighting, you know, and a little bit of greenhouse work, stuff like that, they can extend their growing season. And so there's been a major place where this battle has been going on. Of course, here in Jackson County, in Southern Oregon, has been another major war front, you know, on this battle with Monsanto and Syngenta. They're both involved in this Roundup Ready, because the Roundup Ready patent actually expired quite a while ago. And so the explosion of generics is kind of absurd. There's supposed to be like over 2,000 products now that are manufactured by other companies that contain glyphosate in them. And so, you know, this genie got way out of the bottle. This thing could have been stopped in Vietnam, if not sooner. And it could have not got to this level had we not allowed the patenting of life, because that's essential here. And I think if you pull back those two things, and also I think if the USDA would have banned the concept of killer gene, which is the a seed that cannot reproduce. You know, you get one crop out of it, and then the seed from the next crop will not be viable. And that's something that has been engineered into these plants and is now escaping into the wild. And we're seeing the effects of this gene being transferred across into other life, not just plants, but also into the animals that feed on it. And it's probably only going to get worse because of the fact that you're going to have to use more and more of this stuff because it doesn't work anymore. Like I said, the plants that they were trying to kill with this was like a wild amaranth they call pigweed. It's now thriving. It actually lives off of glyphosate now rather than it just burning it to death. It's figured out a way to metabolize this stuff. And it passed the gene, which allows the ineffectiveness of the glyphosate in the first place, right? So the whole point was to spray just your plants that you want to keep and everything else dies, right? If you're just going through and pesticide spray the whole crop and you don't have to be selective. And so now I found out, you know, that this isn't going to work because if you just spray it everywhere, the other plants are getting a lot more exposure and they're a lot more motivated to survive. They're a lot more capable of evolving. And the soil element, I think, has been under appreciated. So the effect this stuff has, which it really is a kind of a salt. That's something that they always like to say, oh, it's just salt. Anybody remember Sherman? You know, the sort of thing that happened at the end of the Civil War where salt was applied throughout the South to prevent the growth of crops.
That's what the Romans used to do when they would conquer people to bring them to their knees and make them beg for food. They'd salt the fields.
Right, because it could take years for that stuff to wash out, if ever. And so it's a way to cause long-term damage.
Yeah, you see very much stuff growing along the coast. There are plants that can live off of this kind of salty, brackish water that they live on, and that's about it. It's kind of a.
And they're all specially evolved to have low surface areas for their leaves. They're really thick. They have a lot of protections, and they can metabolize the salt, or they can survive the salt anyway. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the point is that nature knows best. That's my rule of thumb. These guys that think they know better are cocky and arrogant, and they're costing the rest of us our health. That's where it gets to be a problem. If they just want to be cocky and arrogant and sit in their little white towers and cook up this stuff, great. I hope it kills them. But then they're going to spread it around the rest of us.
Let's get to some practical examples so people can realize that this is affecting everybody in the United States, not just a few people that can't eat bread.
How about the fact that Roundup Ready alfalfa is already approved and can be served to animals, which can then still be certified organic? So you could eat a beef that you think has never been exposed to pesticide, but it could have been fed crops which contained this gene that makes them the Roundup Ready gene, which, you know, there's no reason to plant that plant if you're not also using the glyphosate. So that's the real issue. And that the USDA is corrupt to the point where they allowed that to happen.
They're actually a branch of Monsanto now. So
yes,
this I just found this today on the internet. There's a I don't know exactly when this MIT researcher came out with this, but it was posted today on a health site. He stated that glyphosate herbicide is going to cause half of all children born to have autism by the year 2025.
Wow.
And that would be one out of two. This used to be something that was, you know, really rare, like one out of 40,000.
Yeah, even 10 years ago when I was studying the effects and the similarities between celiac disease and autism, the numbers at that time were parallel, which was 1 in 133. And that was already at that time a concern, because that would be a massive increase over the previous couple of generations, where it may have occurred 1 in 1,000, 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000, maybe something like that.
Yeah.
And so it seems to be increasing at an alarming pace. And there's a similar story that came out this week about autism, which sort of points to that being a connection with gut bacteria, which is that a guy sort of fought with his pediatrician to get a refill on his son's antibiotics. And the premise, what he argued, was that his son had very severe autism, but that while he was taking these antibiotics, he actually seemed to be coming out of it. He seemed to be improving. And so he wanted to extend the time period to see if he got better still. And the doctor sort of argued with him and said, well, there's no way that there's any connection, and you're just seeing this, and I'm not going to be responsible for harming your child, and yada, yada, yada. But, you know, what the connection is like we've been saying here, is that we're symbiotes. We cannot survive without these bacteria. They're essential to our life, and we only get them when we're born and through our food. So you have a finite amount of it that you're going to get, and you know you're going to get a lot less of it if your diet consists of foods which have all been heavily coated in pesticide.
Because remember when we first started, if it's enough to kill a grasshopper, it's sure enough to kill that bacteria.
Yeah, right. And that's the whole thing. If you really want to think about people as just skin and bones, then you're not really aware of what's going on, because people are extremely complicated, and we're vastly outnumbered by like 20 to 1 by bacterial cells versus our own cells. Our own DNA has inserted in it these codes for these bacteria.
Yeah, that's right. I was reading about that.
This is how we are.
Too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing.
This is how we've been evolved. We cannot survive without these things. I mean, this kind of gets back to something that really was a life changer for me when I was first going 10 years ago studying the connection here with celiac disease. I was exposed to pesticide throughout my entire life. I don't know that it was glyphosate, but I don't suspect that it wasn't. It was a commercial version of it, you know what I mean? Like a maybe even stronger, maybe something closer to this 2,4-D, in that it was used on the pear trees prior to the bud, and you know, so the fruit supposedly wouldn't have been affected, and they were allowed to you know, ridiculously coat these trees. They would spray them from aircraft, which were mostly World War II surplus fighters that had been converted into sprayers. And the pilot who flew over my house specifically had one arm. He was a vet, and everybody around here knew him. And we used to wave at him, and he would wave back, and while he was doing a dive towards our house. And so he'd have to flip on the spray earlier, because he's using his one hand to wave and to fly the plane. And so he'd have to kick the thing on a little early, and he'd end up spraying all the kids and half the neighborhood. And, you know, and then they knocked the orchard down one morning, and the next month or two, they start building a golf course. And so now they're using more Roundup than anything. And they're also looking into that Roundup Ready grass that Scotts is manufacturing. Right now it's in Kentucky, but they're going to bring it over here to Oregon next. And
all right, 'cause this is a grass-producing state.
Yeah. And Salem, the Willamette Valley is the number one grass producer, you know, in the United States, probably in North America. And their purpose, you know, their intent here is to bring the Roundup Ready gene into everyday life, because it will be in your lawn, and then it'll be in your golf course, and it'll be in your country club garden. It'll be in everything. So, and the schools, the fields and schools and stuff. So anyway, their avenue here is profit strictly. And
well, you know, I don't want to make it sound like we're against people making a profit,
because I don't
we're
have
both
any profit.
Businessmen and we yeah, can't have to have a profit.
There's a way to make a profit,
but
and
there's
follow the rules.
There's a way to make a profit because you're actually benefiting somebody else, which that's kind of admirable, to make a profit, and it's a voluntary exchange, and everybody's better off. That's really something to be admired. But right. by cheating to get people in control of regulatory agencies that can give you a pass on everything you do, whether it's right or wrong, that's criminal, and that should be those people should be imprisoned, as they're putting other people's lives at risk for their own benefit and profit, and that's no different really than armed robbery or something like that. It's a
big white collar crime for sure.
Yeah. They're using force and coercion to profit from.
Right. So yeah, I'm not
whatever they're doing.
Definitely not dogging the profit. I mean, if that's their sole motivation,
yeah, and they have no integrity.
Right. If your sole motivation was to make better food, to make it healthier for people, then I'm all for that. But that is not their goal. They'll tell you that. That's one of their biggest excuses of why they can get away with this stuff. It's for the children, and all.
You know, and they get a lot of people that are out there that are you know, just hear the words free market and they get all warm and gushy inside, and they get all those people on their side by just telling them this is greater efficiency and right. this is technology in action. This is the, you know, the brave new world we're going towards. And
right.
And those people just forget common sense and even to be skeptical at all. They just, mm-hmm. And they're the same people that used to buy, basically alcohol dressed up as medicine when the snake oil salesman would come through the, town yep. in a horse-drawn carriage. Same people. They just will believe it because they want to believe it.
Right, and that's actually, to make the perfect connection, the reason why the FDA was created in the first place.
And all those guys did is they got off of their wagon and yep. They took jobs in the FDA.
Right, right. That's they just took over the whole system. So yeah, I know the chief of the FDA right now. Is what Michael Taylor, I think, is
yes.
his name.
He used to be the CEO for Monsanto.
Right, right. So the connections aren't even hiding. In every the USDA director has ties to Monsanto. The revolving door of lobbyists and politicians and stuff is not serving any of us.
Yeah, they start out in the company.
Made it so we can't make this. We can't fix this problem because those guys are all holding up the process.
Mm-hmm. And they're very loyal to the company. They start out in the company and they realize to get advancement, they have to go to work for the government so they can, I don't know if it's proving their loyalty or gaining some credibility with the higher-ups or whatever, but they gain status by being a certain amount of time in the government. They come back to the company at a higher level, and they just keep on doing that stair-stepping thing until they get to the top. Back and forth between the company and government, each time at a higher level of
right.
responsibility.
Right.
And eventually they have control over things which mean life and death to us.
Yeah, this is food. This is water. They have corrupted all of the facilities that we had to keep them in check. So the EPA, the USDA, state and local governments, you name it. In the case here in Oregon, I mean, it was blatant. It was bold how they came in and lobbied for the Monsanto Protection Act, while also getting it inserted into the federal budget. You know, it's surprising that they got away with it here because it was an active vote going on, and you know, we're in the campaign to discuss their outright banning of GMOs in the state. They were not going to be allowed to be produced at all. And then they were allowed to insert language into a bill that allowed essentially blanket protection for them so that they can't be sued, they can't be banned, their products cannot be a target of any legislation at all. And so
yeah, and
it's insane. Nobody else could get away with that. If I try to do that for my business, it would be criminal. If anybody tried to, if General Electric tried to do that, everybody would think that was horrible and wrong.
Well, you're not as powerful as Monsanto.
No. And that's
to point. Show you how powerful they are, though. Even people that are outside of government fear them because
yes,
Monsanto has their fingers in so many companies, so many advertisers. There is not a single news organization that will say a bad word about them.
Right. Because
they're afraid to death.
It'll watch the Weather Channel for a little while and count the Scotts commercials. Scotts being the commercial, the
weed and
residential feed version of Roundup, because it's what it is. It's owned by Monsanto, the whole Scotts company, all their products. Miracle-Gro is in the same boat. It's also owned by Monsanto. So between those two, you'll see, no matter what channel you're watching, probably 10 or 12 ads an hour from those guys. So it's probably in the billions.
Mm-hmm.
And they've written the law in their favor there too. And as a business owner, I kind of appreciate the fact that advertising is a business write-off. But I think it's absurd when they're doing it just for the sake of ensuring their position. Their
public relations.
Yeah.
And so you're not going to get the truth from anybody that relies on advertising for income because they're already
correct. Yeah, that's why
already willing accomplices.
I used to work in commercial television, so I worked in all the local network stations, and each one I saw a wrinkle of this at the local level, and I was kind of surprised. And then I went to PBS because I really have integrity, and I thought I could bring some journalism there, and I thought there'd be some interest in that. And I was not met with any anything but back pressure. The CEO was very adamant that, you know, you cannot say anything that could be used or that could be perceived even as being against the position of any of our sponsors, anyone who gave us money. So the federal government gave us money, so we couldn't say anything bad about the federal government. The state gave us money. The city gave us money. All the big businesses in town, all the major corporations in the United States all give money to PBS, and therefore they tend to just tuck those stories away and go, yeah, that thing about Monsanto, yeah, it's probably a good story, but they give us too much money.
Why don't you find something else to do a story about?
Right. How about little
do puppies? One that won't cost us a job.
Right. Here's a story about this cat. This is going to be great. You know, and so.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm kind of encouraged. I'm ready. I think now I think that there's an audience that has been impatient long enough. There's a bunch of people out there that are not satisfied with the news that they're getting. And they're looking for alternative information. That's why people listen to this show. That's why people listen to Alex Jones. There's probably 50 million more shows.
And but, just to kind of clear the air a little bit here, that's the main reason Alex Jones doesn't want to have sponsors. He doesn't want to be beholden to them. He said at first he just took on people that had products he liked. But even then, he got people that kind of would try and take advantage of that. And he thinks it better if he just sells his own products, and that's how he raises money. And I think that's probably a safer way to go. As if you agree with what he's saying, you can buy his products. If you don't, you don't have to buy them.
Right.
And that's, you know, that way you can voluntarily support his program and get something for it. Now, that's kind of it's kind of our model. Only we don't put that much time and effort into what we do, and we
don't
do have other sources of income. But let's say I mean, we've all talked about this, having maybe a Southern Oregon alternative news, you know, source, and we would have to have some funding in order to do something like that.
I think as a state,
so we would have to have some way to pay.
You know, there's a way to make it a non, I'd say not for profit. The word nonprofit isn't very accurate. Not for profit better describes the function, because there's got to be money changing hands. It's not that, you know, it's got to be transparent. That's the issue with PBS, is that they're very secretive about their funders. They don't want to tell anybody who they get money from, for the most part. They have to because of the law and stuff. But when you're really pushing, when you're really aware, when you really see what's going on a day-to-day basis, you find out ways that they cook the books to hide stuff or to change the names or to push things through different ways. You know, there's a way to get around the tracking or the, you know, whatever disclosure that needs to happen. You know, there's a way to prevent that at the same time. So, I think that it's a good idea, but the only way it works is, well, the way Corporation for Public Broadcasting started was to make an independent fund that nobody was tied to. Nobody knew where the money was coming from necessarily. It was just like the general fund. Everybody's putting in a dollar, like the BBC. Everyone's taxed a flat rate. Everybody pays.
I'm not sure I want to do it through taxation, or I would want to do
I'm
it through taxation. But
that
I think
either.
I think a subscription thing would work just fine, like a newspaper used to be.
Correct.
And we're not going to really sell ads. It's going to be a subscription to content. And
I think that works best. It has to be a voluntary.
Yeah.
And if it was member only, if PBS was only member supported, they would be in a very different position. But they talk about member support a lot, but the reality is it's probably 10 or 15%
right
of the total numbers. The real money comes from the Fed. That's a good chunk, is about.
And even unlike NPR, I used to remember when the Jefferson Public Radio would do their fundraisers.
That was
one of the for them, that was one of their bigger sources of income, because they were kind of they subscribed to the network. They weren't part of the network. I don't know exactly.
Because they were also one of the largest radio networks. They have the largest set of transmitters.
All the transmitters and repeaters and things.
Yeah.
And so they, I remember them describing on air that the federal assistance was, you know, was important to them, but that was a small part of their budget. It really, They had an enormous amount of fundraising they had to do compared to a lot of other stations. Like if you were in the back east, it was much easier back there. You didn't have to have much equipment to reach the population base that they had to reach with a much more expensive and hard to get to places. You had to establish transmitter towers and keep them up. And so it was a lot of work. So there's some other things that are different, but I think now that there's this thing called the internet, it makes it kind of an equalizer for
well,
people.
Yeah, and that's, I've been waiting for this for a long time. The internet has been the equalizer. The issue has been open access. So things like, as unpopular as it was, things like getting a ruling about net neutrality is important. Then things like establishing, you know, a fair rate for public access, so low-income people, or just make sure that people in general can maintain access to the internet, because corporations are inclined to keep raising the prices now that we're all using it and we're all hooked on it. They're going to keep, you know, slowly ratcheting up the price
as
much as the market will bear. And that's,
well, and there is a fixed amount of bandwidth. I mean, it's increasing,
true.
Well, that's what they say there is, but
it's not true. I'll just tell you, I mean, honestly, here's the actual facts: is infinity is the definition of fiber optics. So there is absolutely no.
Well, I know that Travis Boyd, when he was on talking about it, said that
it's all bogus. The fact is that here's where the limiting factor is: the NSA, the rate at which they can absorb information that's coming at them.
That makes sense.
They're the bottleneck. Because seriously, I mean, I've talked to people, I've known network engineers for a long, long time. there's a gentleman specifically in San Francisco who has a case that he lost, unfortunately, but he brought up a case, a whistleblower case against the government, where he was required to install a switch in a fiber optic line where it went into a blank red door. Like, there was no outside handle, there was no number on it, and it was just in a, it was inside of their network control center, and the fiber optic line that he was being asked to splice was the entire internet, essentially. So everything AT&T was putting data in on a single fiber optic line, he was required to splice it. He figured out where the splice went, but they wouldn't allow, you know, they didn't tell him this. He had to do some of his own research. And he found that the closet was installed by an NSA operative, and that the trunk that it was connecting to was a single dedicated line that went to Virginia. And so, you know, he was making the argument then, this has been 7 or 8 years ago, he was saying then that essentially this is putting a splitter in the internet where every single piece of information available on the internet is going through the NSA and back again before it comes back to the internet. Yeah, and that, so they were the limiting factor.
We're just about out of time. So I have,
yeah.
Some of you may have come across these new credit cards that have the little chip on them.
Huh.
And in the OLCC stores, they required us to get new machines that are chip readers.
Yeah.
And these machines take about 40 seconds to run a card, where it used to just be a real simple swipe. And it, they have all the information almost as fast as before. In fact, maybe as fast or faster. But then it stops for about 25 or 30 seconds while the encryption on that code goes to the NSA. I'm right. Sure it's going to the NSA. And well, that's no, why it's taking true. Longer.
It yeah, they have
it makes perfect sense now. What you just tell me just made all that come crystal clear to my mind. Okay, there's the music. Thank you, everybody, for listening tonight. Make sure to include Drew and his family in your prayers. And we'll see you next week. We're going to have another Cracker Jack program. Greg, thank you so much for joining us.
You're thanks, Chuck.
Awesome. You're bound to break one more time.